It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. This morning we have an update on a story we first heard this past summer as NPR aired a series about high school dropouts. In that series, we heard from Kenny Buchanan. The 44-year-old dropped out when he was in the ninth grade. We met him not long after he got his GED in Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania. Today, Kenny has a new job and a new outlook on life. Most people in Kenny's hometown, though, are not as lucky. As NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, well-paying jobs are still scarce and businesses simply won't hire unskilled, poorly educated people.
Kenny Buchanan dropped out of school at age 18 and for the next 26 years jumped from job to job and unemployment. Today, he says life is good.
I got a job.
A full-time job.
Yep, I got hired on July. Pays good. It's local and close to home.
Kenny was hired at Sapa, a Swedish company that took over the aluminum extrusion plant once owned by Alcoa. You can't beat having steady work, says Kenny. The anxiety and stress have lifted.
And anybody that loses their job or doesn't have a job will tell you, when you don't have the money, you're always worrying about how you're going to afford to pay this and how you're going to afford to pay for that. It gets stressful. It gets real stressful. But now that I got a job, I'm more relaxed.
With Kenny now working full-time, his wife Jill was able to quit her job as a beautician. She's now spending a lot more time caring for their youngest son and worrying a lot less.
The biggest thing for me was having insurance for my family. That was even more important to me than the money because, having some health issues and that, it was hard not having insurance.
Without his GED, Kenny says he'd still be looking for a job. Even the fast food place that hired him back when he dropped out of high school won't hire anyone these days without a GED or a high school diploma.
41 first, how can I help you?
I'd like two black coffees, please.
Every morning on his way to work, Kenny stops by that same Burger King to get coffee.
This is the place I started, my very first job.
We drive up to the window. A woman walks in front of Kenny's car and waves.
I know her, yeah.
Kenny says it's no longer embarrassing running into people he grew up with, people who've seen him struggle, jobless. These days, he can afford to eat out maybe once a week, buy a new shirt or a blouse for his wife. Still, Kenny says hard times have taught him to be frugal.
Bills come first. The house gets paid first. The major things, you pay your major things first. Whatever's left over,
you save, says Kenny. As we pull out of the parking lot, it's clear that the story of Schuylkill County is not nearly as upbeat as Kenny's. We drive past empty shopping centers, strip malls, and old abandoned warehouses, all signs of a prolonged, struggling economy. Although, farther down the road, there is a company that makes bird feed that's hiring. So is the small local lumber company. A new Kohl's department store is going to open here soon. People without a high school diploma or a GED, of course, need not apply. But even if you have one, neither will guarantee a living wage, says Sharon Angelo. She runs CareerLink, a job counseling and referral center in Schuylkill County.
The economy has picked up slightly, but what we're noticing, too, is you may have employers that pay one salary in Schuylkill County and just go across the border to another facility of theirs and find out that you could get paid more.
With so many people looking for jobs around here, Angelo says, employers don't have to offer more than the minimum wage. Kenny says that's why so many of his friends have left to find something better.
I'm not saying minimal paying jobs are bad, but if you're going to raise a family or if you want things in life, minimum paying jobs just don't cut it. I mean, they just don't.
It's hard to say when or if wages will improve in this economy, but Sharon Angelo says the one thing that seems to be getting worse is the high school dropout rate. She's seeing a lot more dropouts.
I'm talking people who are 17 through 21 years of age. They don't have enough room to accommodate the number of people who are looking for a GED.
Angelo says for every Kenny Buchanan who's come back for his GED and found a good-paying job, there are dozens of dropouts who are unemployable.
I think it's sad. I know.
Kenny says he's lucky.
You can't guarantee nothing in life. But, yeah, I'm fortunate.
He has a family that supports him, a job, and his GED. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Some of the most spectacular business failings of 2011 were created or enhanced by the very people who should have provided protection against failure, CEOs. To tell us about some of the worst offenders, we're joined by Sidney Finkelstein of Dartmouth College's Tuck School of Business. He is the author of Why Smart Executives Fail. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Linda.
Now, you've compiled a list of some of the most egregious management blunders of the year. Let's start with the co-CEOs of Research in Motion, or RIM. That's the company that makes the BlackBerry smartphone.
Well, the co-CEOs of Research in Motion, Mike Lazaridis and Jim Balsillie, are really two people that built their business on that BlackBerry, that one product, and haven't adapted, haven't changed, because the world's changed quite dramatically around them, most obviously with the rise of the iPhone and even Google's Android. There are other things they've done that I think are troubling. This co-CEO structure is almost a guaranteed model for failure. It hardly ever works. It makes it difficult to know who's in charge. And I think that slowed down their ability to adapt to competitors.
Now, another technology company made big headlines this year for some fairly disastrous decisions. HP, the world's largest computer maker. Former CEO Leo Apotheker veered pretty far from the HP way. What was his biggest mistake?
Well, Mr. Apotheker, really, there's so many things that he did wrong. First, let's get rid of the PC business, which became a something like $40 billion business for HP, and then let's keep it. Let's create a new tablet, and then let's drop that almost as soon as possible. Actually, it's one mistake after another in this instance.
Shouldn't the board of directors that hired him take some of the heat on this?
Yes, absolutely. This is also a board of directors that hired Carly Fiorina a few years ago, and she also ended up having a very short tenure. And by the way, these people that become CEOs of HP and then are shown the door typically walk away with $25 or $30 million in severance. That's not going to make a lot of people or shareholders happy for that matter.
Another Silicon Valley company, Netflix, created its own drama this year. CEO Reed Hastings changed the way that people watch television and watch movies. What happened to Mr. Hastings?
Yes, he was very beloved, but he came up with a plan to split the business into two, the traditional DVD order, mail order business, and then the newer streaming business. That in and of itself is not a mistake. However, in the process of doing that, he ended up raising the prices and making it actually much more complex for customers to order what they wanted. I think customers felt betrayed.
But on the other hand, here's a man who was trying to get his company into a new position, not sticking with the old tried and true, which, I mean, it's the opposite from the BlackBerry story.
Yeah, in fact, I like the idea of splitting the company into two. In some ways, that's textbook strategy. You split the company into two to protect the new fledgling business. But the process that he went through has been a disaster. His communication wasn't very good. And I think there's a lot of people that are wondering what is new that they're doing that nobody else can do. And I don't actually think there's very much.
One company that was not quite so widely reported was Johnson & Johnson.
Johnson & Johnson and William Weldon, the CEO, it's almost like a Teflon CEO because there's a lot of stuff that went wrong under his watch this past year. And as you say, hardly anyone ever talked about it. And I'm talking specifically about the incredible number of product recalls in this company. Insulin pumps to sutures, syringes, hip implants, contact lenses, Tylenol, Benadryl, Rolaids, you name it.
Baby shampoo.
And that's not even the whole set of them. And for a company like this to fall down when it comes to quality and safety is, I think it's shocking. And William Weldon is the CEO, and it's happening under his watch.
Is anything going to happen to these guys? I mean, are they likely to lose their jobs? Were there consequences for some of the bad things that happened to good companies?
Well, you know, some have lost their jobs, but it gets back to this issue of boards of directors and how vigilant the boards are in overseeing those organizations. And sometimes they let their CEOs stay in those positions perhaps a little bit too long.
Sidney Finkelstein, thank you very much.
Thanks, Linda. Great to be on.
Sidney Finkelstein is a professor of strategy and leadership at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, many people opted to skip the crowds this year and to do at least some of their holiday shopping online. And yes, they may have saved time and money and hassle, but what about the small business owners whose livelihoods depend on bringing customers into their stores? We'll hear how technology is affecting competition between online and traditional brick-and-mortar stores. That's just ahead. But first, as 2011 winds down, we're taking some time to offer a twist on the traditional end-of-year roundup here at Tell Me More, and in fact, across NPR. We're highlighting people, movements, and ideas that had a good year, and today we're going to take a look at credit unions. Credit unions counted more than a million new members this year, according to the Credit Union National Association, which said that 1.1 million new members were added through October of 2011. The latest American Customer Satisfaction Index showed credit union satisfaction scores jumped 7 points to a record high of 87 out of a possible 100 points. We wanted to hear more about why credit unions had such a good year, so we've called upon our regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy, our money coach, Alvin Hall. Welcome back, Alvin. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you.
Well, first, tell us, how are credit unions different from regular banks or retail banks?
Credit unions are nonprofit cooperatives, so they can't issue shares to people at all. And they are made up of a group of people who come together basically to try to use their money in ways that will help that group of people have easier access to credit, also get mortgages much more easily, but benefit the general population and sometimes the community.
So members of a union, for example,
yes.
Members of a particular employee
group.
Armed Forces Division, like Navy, Federal Credit Union, many ads for
exactly.
them. In the Washington, D.C. area. Now, I think that many people will intuitively understand what started the rush to credit unions this year. Last month, for example, I spoke with Molly Catchpole, who was angry when her bank, Bank of America, planned to charge $5 a month to use debit cards for purchases. She started an online petition that gained hundreds of thousands of signatures in very short order. The bank eventually dropped the fee. I'll just play a little bit of that conversation.
Customers have a right to protest when they're unhappy about something. And I think people haven't been protesting enough when they're unhappy about something. And I just kind of felt like that needed to happen.
Alvin, is it your sense that many people were actually motivated to join credit unions but out of anger over fees like the one that got Molly Catchpole started?
Absolutely. First bank said, don't write checks. We're going to charge you for checks. But if you use your debit card, it'll be okay. It'll be cheaper. And then all of a sudden, they added fees for debit cards. It was just one step too far for many people. And they saw this as the banks using the small guy, the guy who may not be able to maintain that minimum balance, as the source of revenues. And people said, I've had enough.
You know, there does seem to be some data to support that point. There was a grassroots effort called Bank Transfer Day, in which organizers
yes.
urged big bank customers to switch financial institutions on November 5th. And according to the Credit Union National Association, now let's say that this is an industry trade group, but their data showed that almost 700,000 people did in fact join credit unions between September 29th and the first week of November. So it does
yes.
seem as though there is a data point there. But Alvin, I have to ask, is there any downside to a credit union?
Well, it depends upon where you live. For example, if you live in an area where there isn't a credit union that's easily accessible to you, then transferring may be difficult. Also, credit unions typically don't have as many branches. They can be part of a broad network, but it may cost you to use some of those ATMs, some of those ones that are part of the other network. So there can be downsides. You should always look to make sure it's appropriate for you. But what people like about credit unions is the fact that they seem to be much more personal. They're not there to try to exploit you. When they hear the term shareholder value these days from these big banks, they think, the shareholder value will be the fees that they charge on my account, not that rich guy's account.
So it can be physically inconvenient. And if you
yes.
want that personal service, it can be actually harder to get because
you have to
travel farther to go. What if you don't belong to a union or an employee group or the military or other groups like that that automatically have a credit, or not automatically, but for whom credit unions have been longstanding? What do you do? And if you're interested in joining one, do you have any option?
It's hard to do that because I've thought about this. I actually am one of those people who left the big bank this year to move to a smaller bank that would offer me better customer service, and I personally couldn't find a credit union that was appropriate for me and my needs. So I think that some people won't have that as an option. But if you look, maybe there's a group you can join, a church-related organization that's affiliated with a credit union. There are all these aspects of our individual lives which may give us access to one, but we have to do the research. And that's important. Do your research. Make sure that the fees are lower. Make sure that it is convenient for you, and that if you wanted to support a particular cause or something in your community, that is actually doing it.
What about the regulatory framework? Who's looking over the shoulders of these institutions? Because obviously, if you know, any institution can be subject to, you said, you already told us that there isn't the same profit incentive, because these are by definition non-profits.
Yes.
They don't have shareholders to satisfy. They only have their customers to satisfy, but they still have to be run by somebody. Is there anybody looking over the shoulder of
the credit institutions? The same institutions. They have to be a member of the Federal Reserve System, so your accounts will be insured. They have to meet all of the necessary requirements from the Federal Reserve Banking System. All of those are set up. And then there's their own advocacy group, which is out there making sure that the rules and regulations are fair to them. But you know, Michelle, that's also a very good question, because if credit unions eventually become very successful as a result of this movement, they will capture the attention of the big banks. And the big banks will then, I think, try to challenge them if this movement continues.
And do you think that is going to be my last question, actually, in the couple of seconds that we have left? Do you think that this move to away from the big banks, and obviously the big banks still have a huge, you know, share of the market. I mean, 700,000 people sounds like a lot, but it is in the big scheme of things. You know, most people still bank at one of these large retail institutions, or they're unbanked, as we've discussed. Do you think that this move toward credit unions will continue?
Yes, I do. I think it will gradually spread across the economy. As more and more people are trying to save money, trying to use their money most effectively, why do they want to pay these fees? And as one lady observed in some article that I read, you know that if a bank charged a fee yesterday and they may have pulled it back, they'll come up with another fee tomorrow, because they're always looking for new fees or a way to try to make up for money that they feel they've lost as a result of new regulations.
Alvin Hall is our regular expert on matters of personal finance and the economy. He's our money coach, and he joined us from our studios in New York. Thank you, Alvin, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
We are nearing the end of an unusual year for movies. No single film has dominated the conversation in Hollywood. Some celebrated films this year refer to the past of the movie industry itself, like the silent film The Artist, or Hugo, which becomes a tale of old film preservation. Today, thousands of people in the industry get a chance to say what they think of all this as the first Oscar ballots are mailed out. Kim Masters is covering the Oscar race and the campaigning that goes along with it. She is editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us from NPR West once again. Kim, hi.
Hi, Steve.
So does this feel like an unusual year to you?
You know, in some ways it feels like a very unusual year, and in some ways it doesn't feel like such a bad year. I mean, overall, the industry, the movie business is in a tough situation. You know, the box office numbers have not been there. What used to be a $60 million opening is now a $20 million opening. So they're trying to figure out the future, and the studios are, as you know, Steve, cranking out a lot of sequels and comic book heroes. And so that's the negative. The good part is we actually have a clutch of movies that are not embarrassing to nominate. So, and there, in years past, I've had trouble coming up with even five that I thought were worthy of a mention. And this year, there are more than five, I think, that could be nominated and not embarrass the movie business.
Okay. Who reaches that not embarrassing threshold? A couple of them anyway.
I think the distinct front runner right now has to be The Artist, the film you mentioned. Black and white, silent. And, of course, it's a Valentine to the movie business. You know, it feels different and fresh. And so I think right now, if you had to pick one, that's the one. But also right up there in the top of the pack, The Descendants, George Clooney starring as a bereaved father who's struggling.
Yeah.
And The Help, which was based on the Catherine Stockett novel and, you know, is very well received, kind of an unexpected hit. Steven Spielberg's War Horse seems to be playing pretty well. I think it will certainly make the list. I wouldn't be surprised to see Bridesmaids get in there to the top list, maybe Woody Allen. Midnight in Paris. You know, that's not a short list. That's a decent list.
Okay, that's quite a clutch of movies, as you put it. Actually starts to make me feel a little bit better about this year's movies when you list them out like that, Kim Masters. But then there's the question of the Oscars themselves. Are they struggling a little bit to stay relevant right now?
Oh, yeah. It's been a struggle for years. I mean, the show still draws a big, big audience. But we've already seen this year the producer was going to be Brett Ratner when Eddie Murphy was going to host. And then there was a whole blow up with inappropriate comments and behavior from Ratner. And he was out. And then Eddie Murphy was out. And now we're back to Billy Crystal. Doesn't feel quite like 2012 is going to break ground. But, you know, he's a good host.
Well, in past years, we've been here talking about how they expanded the list of Best Picture nominees from 5 to 10. And this year, there will be how many?
You know, that is a good question because they've devised this strange voting system, which is based on how many vote for this picture at number one. And don't ask me to explain it. But I think most people are thinking it's going to be about 8. They're trying to make it interesting. They're trying to make it a horse race. You know, when you don't have a film like Titanic, which is where you have a very popular film, you pull in big, big audiences that are very attached to a particular movie emotionally. When you have a year like this where you don't have that huge blockbuster success, you know, you try to throw in as many as possible without, as I said earlier, making it an embarrassing list.
Kim Masters, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
She's of The Hollywood Reporter and also hosts The Business on member station KCRW. And let's go next to Texas, where a private intelligence company has apparently been hacked by the loosely organized activist group known as Anonymous. The Austin-based company, Stratfor, provides security analysis for major financial and technology firms, including Apple. Anonymous claims it obtained personal information about the company's high-profile clients, as well as thousands of credit card numbers, which were then used to make donations to charities like Save the Children and the Red Cross.
Some Anonymous members have reportedly disavowed hacking Stratfor. Freelance journalist Quinn Norton has profiled Anonymous for Wired magazine. She's been talking online to members of AntiSec, an arm of Anonymous, taking credit for this latest breach. We reached her via Skype in San Francisco. Quinn, welcome back to our program.
Thank you for having me.
The vice president for intelligence of the company which was hacked, Stratfor, has told the Associated Press that he's called in the law. They've pulled down their website. But he went on to say that he thinks that hackers are extraordinarily difficult to defend against. For a security company, does that sound right to you?
Oh, yeah. The hardest part of security is what's called intrusion detection. And that's a matter of knowing whether or not you've been hacked. The way it's openly discussed in the security community is if somebody wants to hack into you, eventually they will manage it.
What we're hearing, and we have to say that almost all of the facts, apart from the fact of the hack, are coming from Anonymous, but we're hearing that people who paid for Stratfor services with credit cards find they are making involuntary donations to charities. A couple of people have come forward and said that they have discovered these involuntary donations. What happens if you find you've suddenly given money to Save the Children and you didn't do it?
Well, this is a fairly standard part of credit cards these days. So there's already a system for handling this. People can report the fraudulent charges. As with any fraudulent charges, they'll be reversed. The money will be claimed back from the charity, which means this can actually be very damaging for the charities that have dubiously benefited because they're going to be hit with something called a chargeback. They're not going to get to keep that money. In some cases, they'll face penalties as well.
This reminds me of a brand new movie, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which highlights a community of hackers that are said to be the best of the best in their fictional world. And they have all sorts of rules about what they will hack and what they will do. But they consider themselves a sort of hacker elite. Do you think we're seeing something like that getting started here?
Well, the particular wing of Anonymous that has done this goes by AntiSec. And a little bit like that fictional group, AntiSec has kind of a specific set of values about how and when they do these sorts of hacks. These hacks most recently have been fairly politically motivated. They're in response to events that we're seeing go by in the news. They do put out a fairly steady stream of announcements and press releases. The evictions and crackdowns on the Occupy Wall Street movement get a lot of mention as to what's motivating this set of more political hacks. The other thing the AntiSec people are claiming to have done is they've transferred out of the company 200 gigabytes of email, which represents somewhere between 2.4 and 2.5 million emails.
So we should take this very seriously, not so seriously. It's the new world we live in. What?
This is very serious, and it is the new world we live in. I feel like if it's online, we should consider very strongly that someday it will be public. And that's the new reality that I think governments and corporations are really going to have to learn to live with.
Thank you very much, Quinn Norton.
Thank you.
Quinn Norton is a journalist who covers the digital world. Antisec says it intends to release more hacked material today.